It was a great pleasure once again to interview Craig Braddock for my Nostalgia Interviews podcast, but with a difference, because Craig is an expert on television sport from the monochrome era. So we talk for an hour about various sporting events from the 1948 Olympics to the 1966 World Cup, and how TV has defined sport as a medium. Craig talks about pre-World War II women's amateur sport, which came to prominence in the 1948 London Olympics, and how there's very little of the event in the archives. It gives us the genesis of what we are used to in TV sport coverage today. Then we've got the 1953 FA Cup final, the oldest soccer broadcast in the archives. This is when TV, for the first time, became the first choice over radio for experiencing sport. Then we've got Roger Bannister and the 4-minute mile. It was all on a programme called Sports View, which was the first show in the UK to use an autocue. Then we've got the launch of Grandstand in 1958, and later its Football Results teleprinter. It introduced people to regional sports events. Craig talks about David Coleman's expertise and how the programme covered the Grand National for the first time in 1960, which again united people around television. We look at the 1964 Olympics in Tokyo, which was broadcast by satellite, and then at the end of the programme, we talk about the 1966 World Cup final, when the BBC and ITV worked together to share facilities. It was the first time slow motion was used in real time in football coverage, and gave other countries the chance to develop their own coverage of football. It was also a time, as Craig discusses, when football and politics came together. And we end the interview by finding out how Craig plans to draw on all of his knowledge in the future. It was a huge pleasure once again to catch up from Arizona with Craig Braddock for the latest in my series of Nostalgia Interviews. My name is Chris DC. Well, it's a great pleasure once again to catch up with Craig Braddock. And Craig, when we were interviewing last, of course, you spoke in great detail and with such enthusiasm about your real passion for TV history, and particularly the history of TV sport in the monochrome era. And it's a real privilege to catch up once again. And of course, actually, in the light of having seen the film Jockey, which of course was filmed on your racetrack in Arizona.
Yes, it was. And the film was very good. We were all delighted here at Surf Paradise that the film was so widely received. It's now being distributed by Sony Pictures on DVD and on streaming services later this month on various platforms. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping that a lot of people will continue to watch the film and enjoy it.
And I have to say, because quite coincidentally, I was scheduled to put the interview with you out on the day that I ended up seeing the film. It was actually the only showing in the part of the world where I am, and it was at the multiplex, and it was in the biggest screen in the multiplex, and it wasn't completely full. But I was saying, and they were saying to me at the cinema in Dover, in Kent, saying, do you know anything about this film? And I said, not only that, I know somebody who works there. So I was chatting about my podcast, chatting about the interest here. So I was sitting there watching this film and just thinking, I know somebody who works there in Arizona. So it was a real privilege to sort of watch this quite indie film in a multiplex and to have that personal connection. So I did my bit anyway to spread the word, and I hope that it got at least generated a few more sales. But do you want to say a little bit about, Craig, about your interest in TV sport?
Sure. Well, I've always been interested in television history anyway, and I was lucky enough, as we discussed in my previous interview, to be mentored by many race callers when I was a kid and as a teenager, and many of those people worked in sport on television in the early days. So really, I began learning from them at a pretty early age, and that just encouraged my interest to go back and look through archives and books in those days at how sport developed as a medium on television. And over time, I began to learn about the technical aspects of sports broadcasting in the early days. And of course, it's very easy to look back when we do nostalgia style interviews and say things were always better back in the day. But the reality, of course, is often they were not. But especially with sports on television, from the earliest days of television, even pre-World War II, sport was something that was always in demand to be watched. The idea of watching a sporting event live, it unites people in a community. And what I'd like to look at with you in this particular interview is six or seven events that took place during the monochrome era of television from 1948, the London Olympics, which was really the first big sporting event after World War II, to the 1966 World Cup finals, but obviously in England, as we all know, and England won. And see, not only looking at the development from a chronological viewpoint, but also looking at some of the social impacts these events had on the population as a whole, as well as looking at how television helped to define sport as a medium, and so that it became what is now. I mean, nowadays we have, you know, dozens of channels showing sport all the time, but back then that was not the case. And in our case today, we're primarily going to be looking at BBC Sport from 1948 to 1966. Obviously, commercial television didn't start in the UK until 1955. And it wasn't really until the 1968 ITV franchise changes when ITV Sport became a brand on its own. So there isn't much in the archives from the early days of ITV Sport, unfortunately, although we will touch on them regarding the 1966 World Cup finals. But this is primarily going to be oriented towards BBC coverage in that era.
Yeah, and I think it would be good, wouldn't it, to start then with the London Olympics, 1948, and you were very helpful, actually, I have to say, in giving me a good sort of background to the particular case study, shall we say, that we're going to be looking at. And you were telling me that it was in the 1948 London Olympics that was the first time women's sports were shown alongside men's events on television.
Yes, if you go back to the very early days of television, pre-World War II, a lot of amateur sport was shown, and it was a lot of indoor sports, snooker, boxing, anything that could be shown in a contained environment. And if you go back into old radio times, there actually was a surprising amount of women's amateur sport shown pre-World War II in the BBC's attempts at broadcasting sport. But it was really the 1948 London Olympics where we had this phenomenon where men's and women's sports were shown equally for the first time. Now, in large part, that wasn't through design. It was a result of the technical limitations at the time. The 1948 London Olympics essentially was broadcast with pre-World War II television equipment. CPS Emmetron cameras were used. Super Emmetron cameras were just coming on the scene at the time. A few of those were used as well. But if you know about television history, you'll probably know the first big outside broadcast for the BBC was the coronation of King George VI in 1937. And much of the same equipment was used to cover the 1948 London Olympics. One big difference was the BBC and the IOC built what we would now call a broadcast center for the first time. They actually had a proper broadcast center, although it was mainly radio-based. Over 140 different countries had radio coverage of the 1948 Olympics. There was a television component as well. And women's sport was shown because they had to set up cameras that were going to be in stadiums all day, and men's and women's events took place. Probably the most famous woman athlete associated with the 1948 Olympics was the Dutch runner Fanny Blankers-Koen, who won four gold medals at track and field, and they were all covered by the BBC in that particular era. And she was undoubtedly the star of the 1948 Olympics. But when we look back at the coverage, television in the UK was only in the southeast at the time. You could basically draw a 30-mile radius around Alexandra Palace, and that was pretty much it. I remember my maternal grandmother, who lived in Cambridge and was fairly well off, they had a television in 1948, and they were just outside the coverage area, and more or less they could get coverage on a good day. So it was really only in London, what we would think of nowadays as the metropolitan London area, that could receive coverage of it. There's very little in the archives of the 1948 London Olympics as far as tele recordings go. There are some of the opening ceremony, and there are a few brief highlights of a few events in the archives. As far as the coverage of the Olympics goes, the Olympics ran for 17 days that particular year. All of the events were in the southeast of England, from Portsmouth to Aldershot, and primarily track field events and football, show jumping. The events that, you know, we come to think of as being associated with the Olympics were all held in the London area. And over the 17 days, BBC television showed nearly 70 hours of live coverage, which averages out at about 5 a day. On one day, they managed to do 8 hours of continuous coverage, which was an enormous achievement at the time. As far as commentating on sports goes, it was in its earliest infancy as far as television was concerned. BBC Radio was such a world leader in those days. Television got no more than 1 or 2% of the BBC's entire budget for the year in 1948. So the commentators they had weren't, as you would imagine, people who had necessarily had a radio background. They were actually people who were coming into television as a new medium. Peter Dimmock, who we'll talk about through this, was their first outside broadcast manager after World War II. And he had people like Richard Dimbleby, for an example, doing the opening ceremonies and doing some of it. People like Raymond Glendenning, who were experienced broadcasters, were working on radio at that time. So they had a lot of news journalists come in as well to help with the television, and a new era of commentators around that time began appearing as well. You had people like Max Robertson, although not as an Olympic commentator, people like Peter O'Sullivan in horse racing as well, were taking up television as a new career, a new medium of broadcasting. And really, they had to make the rules up as they went along. When you consider that in the 1948 Olympics, most people were watching television on a 10-inch by 8-inch screen. It was fairly remarkable what they were able to do as far as from a technical viewpoint. You can begin to see the genesis of how we cover sports today. We had wide angle shots for the most part. It was very difficult to intersperse and cut shots in this era. The BBC made up 3 outside broadcast trucks for the 1948 Olympics. And again, because of World War II and the British television industry couldn't really provide production monitors and so on, they were using domestic receivers inside these trucks to try and juggle everything around. They had very primitive sound equipment to deal with as well. But they were able to put on a show every day in the London area. And this proved to the BBC at the time but you could actually transmit sports in a way that would, A, keep people entertained. Now, you could argue, of course, but you didn't have to keep people entertained because it was the only thing around at the time. But we began seeing the building blocks of what came from that. I wish we had more in the archives from the 1948 Olympics. We don't. But as a footnote, that's where outside broadcasts of sports really started in the modern era.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you about that, actually, because obviously these days all sorts of footage appears. People can record on their VCRs, as they used to be, obviously, stuff from television, and you always sort of find that there are old episodes of TV programmes that no one thought existed anymore. But and particularly when programs were wiped from the archives completely in the 80s, for example. But in your case, you know, trying to look at the 1948 Olympics, what was you? I mean, how much of this are you able to piece together in terms of actual footage, you know, televised footage, and perhaps, you know, is it the case that the rest of it comes from the books that have been written or the newspaper articles from that era?
Yeah, there's only around 600 feet of footage of tele-recording from the 1948 Olympics. So most of it is pieced together from books, from Radio Times listings, from second-hand accounts of people who were there at the time. They did have the idea of having a presenter. They had the idea of having specialist commentators at different events. They began experimenting with what we would now call co-commentators as well, bringing in people who had a background in the sports they were covering to maybe add comments as well. So the building blocks were there, but unfortunately we can't see much of what actually took place, but we can, by looking back at a record, see where they were certainly starting to go down a path that nowadays would look familiar to us.
And do you think at the time, I mean, with hindsight, you know, we can look at it and say, you know, 1948, the London Olympics, you know, it was a real sort of, I was about to say grandstand moment. We'll come on to that in a minute. But is there a sense in which they knew that history was being made? Is there a sense in which at the time it was aware that this is what posterity would be watching? Or is that just, you know, the lens through which we in later years and decades have decided to imbue that particular event?
Oh, it's undoubtedly that. At the time, it was considered to be very of the moment, very experimental. They didn't have much in the way of an idea of what it would mean in the future. One of the things I was taught by many of the older commentators who were around in the 1940s and 1950s was this idea that sports broadcasting is like a pyramid. And at the base of the pyramid, you have people who don't really know much about sport, but they might be interested in learning. The middle section are people who are interested in sport in general. And the top section are those who are interested in that particular sport. And you've got to not only base your commentary, but base the TV production at getting that widest part of the pyramid that's the lowest part. And the idea is that in time, you begin moving people up that pyramid so they become more knowledgeable about sport. And that was very much in play by this time in BBC documentation. As a guide for commentators, for producers, this is what we want to do. We want to try to encourage participation in sport. We want to try to encourage people to become knowledgeable about sport. For one thing, it cost the BBC a great deal of money. They needed to be able to justify a reason to do so. And if they wanted to cover more sport in the future, they had to be able to televise it successfully. So maybe they had that in mind. But certainly not, they weren't thinking, oh my God, in 70 years' time, people are still going to be talking about this.
And also, I mean, in terms of the democratization of it, because when you consider that, of course, through TV, you know, the number of people who'll be able to say, I saw that final, I saw that event, I saw that particular coverage, because they saw it on a black and white TV in their homes or their neighbors' homes, they may not have had a TV themselves, rather than, you know, the privilege of actually being there on the stand. So TV certainly made sure that sports, and not, you know, not just the local sports with your local team, but on an international scale, were available to a wider population.
Yeah, and that moves us on really to our next landmark event, the 1953 FA Cup final. Now, in 1952, the Festival of Britain highlighted television and its potential to many people. A lot more people took up the ownership, or in those days, higher purchase of televisions. By 1952, you could more or less get television in most of the country. The Kirker Shots transmitter in Scotland opened in 1952. The Holmes transmitter, for the North of England opened in 1950. So, you know, by this time we were, you know, more or less a nationwide country as far as television goes. And in 1953, there were three big events in television. First of all, you had the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II, which many people bought a television for. But a few weeks before that, you had the 1953 FA Cup final, which is the oldest entire soccer broadcast in the archives anywhere in the world. And the entire match with Kenneth Wolstenholme as the commentator is available. You can actually watch it on YouTube. And it's known as the Stanley Matthews final because at the age of 38, playing for Blackpool, he finally won an FA Cup winner's medal. They beat Bolton Wanderers 4-3. He didn't actually score any of the goals in it. Stan Mortensen scored a hat-trick and Bill Perry also scored for Blackpool. But Matthews set up a couple of the goals. And when you look at the coverage of that now, this was really the first event that had a degree of made for television around it. And when I say that, Kenneth Wolstenholme, who perhaps now 70 years later sounds very much like a commentator from a bygone era. But if you listen to his commentary of the 1953 FA Cup final, there's the odd comment in there about, well, when we spoke to so-and-so before the game, and when you look back in the listings, yes, they actually did interview people before the game. And the commentator referring to that kind of interaction before the game and bringing people along for the journey in broadcasting the game really was the first time we can identify, okay, the commentator is not there just describing what's going on. He's actually in a position where he's taking people through FA Cup final day. He's making references to what we saw earlier. They had five cameras in Wembley Stadium that day. If you go back and look at it now, there's a lot of problems with the broadcast, even for them. The pillars in the grandstand often get in the way. The wide shots are often too wide, but you can't really see the progress of play very well. There's a few, yeah, a lot of the time there's attempts to use different lenses that don't necessarily work very well. They're not high enough. A lot of the time the camera positions are not sufficiently high enough to get a good view of what's going on. But certainly by 1953, you could begin seeing that in Kenneth Wolstenholme's commentary, it's not a radio-style commentary. There's moments where there's silence, where you can actually hear the crowd noise. And that's one of the things that comes over when we look at broadcasts now, is it's very atmospheric of a different time, because there's plenty of time when the commentators aren't talking a great deal, and you can take in the atmosphere of the day. Unfortunately, there wasn't the technology to give a lot of crowd shots at the time, but the primitiveness of the technology in many ways gives it an immediacy that has lasted through the decades. It is more like being there than the polished events we've had since then. And you definitely get a feeling you're more of a person in the grandstand watching it, as opposed to someone up on high watching it with 28 different cameras. Probably from a social viewpoint, the 1953 FA Cup final was the first sports event where, as you alluded to earlier, people who had televisions watched it. And if their neighbor had a television, they came around and watched it. And it was probably the first what we would think of as event sports television at the time. They had a little bit of build-up to the program. They had a little bit afterwards with the presentation ceremony and so on. Again, they had a host in the studio. They had a specific match commentator. They didn't really have any experts. Kenneth Wolstenholme was on his own for the entire 90 minutes, but again, that was the style and the technical limitations of the time. But this was the first time we can honestly say television was probably the preferred choice over radio to experience the FA Cup final. Television was available nationwide. if you didn't have a television, you probably knew someone by this time who had access to a television. Pubs began getting televisions for the first time around that time. So we have this social aspect, again, of people starting to gather around to watch a specific event. Obviously, the biggest manifestation of that a few weeks later was in the coronation. And there's plenty of books and there's plenty of documentation out there about the social impacts that had. And then later in the year, you begin getting TV shows like the original broadcast of the Quatermass experiment, which, you know, one could argue was perhaps the first big television event that people began watching on a week-by-week basis. And so we've got this blooming of a new medium. And we're very lucky that the 1953 FA Cup final remains in the archives for us to be able to look back now and see from very basic beginnings of the 1948 Olympics to 1953. The language of television had started to evolve by this time. Kenneth Wolstenholme makes various comments about Stanley Matthews, even when he's not really on the ball. You get the idea that they're framing this match around one man's attempt to finally win an FA Cup winner's medal. And this is the first time we see in live television, at the very least, an attempt to give a greater context than just broadcasting the match itself. Nowadays, we take for granted there's going to be names and characters in sports events to follow. Back in 1953, that was something very new, had never been seen before. And remarkably, looking back at newspaper clippings from the time, it was actually very well received, that style of broadcasting, as opposed to just saying, you know, so-and-so has the ball, passes it to so-and-so. The narrative feature of broadcasting began showing itself at that time, as opposed to the 1948 Olympics, which was more just broadcasting as it happened.
Yeah, and I like the idea as well of it being the Stanley Matthews final. But of course, Stanley Matthews was just was the star player, but rather than someone who actually is scored in the match and in that sense. But of course, also that was the draw for people to go and watch it. But moving on to 1954, and of course, this was Roger Bannister's big moment. Now, of course, you're obviously far more knowledgeable than I am in this area, but the 4-minute mile, now that was a real landmark, wasn't it, in broadcasting?
Yeah. I mean, we have to remember this was an entirely man-made record. There's no particular reason why it was. But ever since the Helsinki Olympics in 1952, there was this idea, someone's going to break the 4-minute mile. Now, Sports View was a program designed by Paul Fox, who was a journalist at the BBC, eventually became head of Yorkshire Television. And he and Peter Dimmock wanted a news program for the BBC. It eventually inspired Sports Night with Coleman, Sports Night further down the road. But Sports View was really the first show where it looked back at the previous week's sports events. It looked forward to the coming weekend's sports events. And it was a news program as opposed to a magazine-style sports show. And they wanted the latest events. And they tried to push the boundaries of that. They did all kinds of things. They sent Raymond Baxter out in a Mini to drive in the Monte Carlo rally a few times and stuff like that. But to get back to Roger Bannister, the fourth week of Sports View being broadcast, there was an athletics meet at Ilfi Road in Oxford, where Oxford University ran their athletics meets. And there was the race was a special attempt, really. Chris Chataway was a pacemaker for Roger Bannister to try and achieve the 4-minute mile. And Norris McWhirter, who was in charge of the statistics at the time for British Athletics, sort of said, you know, to the BBC, you know, I think you need to bring a camera out here just in case. And of course, it happened, you know, Roger Bannister did it in 3 minutes 59. I think it was 3/5 of a second in those days. It wasn't like to the 100th of a second as it is now. But clearly, he was the first man to break it. And Sports View were there for it. They rushed him back to London that night to do a live interview. It scooped all the newspapers, which was a huge deal. at the time, and it really put BBC onto the map, not only as a broadcaster of sports, but of a broadcaster of sports news. This was something bigger than just covering an event in itself. This was a landmark moment, and it really cemented the idea with the British public that sports was more than just this ethereal thing that happened, and once it happened, it had gone away. Here was something where within 2 or 3 hours of it happening, we had the guy in the studio, we had footage of the event, they got Max Robertson to, you know, do a little voiceover for it, and that night people were able to sit down and speak to the man who had just broken the 4-minute mile. It was an amazing achievement by Roger Bannister at the time. And I mean, I do think it's one of these events that in 100 years time, people will still say Roger Bannister was the first man to break the 4-minute mile.
And I was just thinking as well, because obviously he's the first person to break the 4-minute mile, but he was the first person to break the 4-minute mile when it was recorded and recorded on television. So the key thing is that that was when that was, it was the coalescence of, you know, in that sense, Norris McWhirter, whether he was the actual one with the stopwatch, I don't know, but actually,
he was.
Timing it. And then also the fact that it was on television. So that's the thing that's legendary. It's the fact that it was recorded, the fact that we have video evidence of it taking place.
Well, we actually, of course, there's actually film evidence of it taking place. We didn't have video at the time. Yeah. But yeah, the idea behind Sports View, one of the things, if you look back at BBC's documentation, is a big thing was to get a development tank, next to the studio, so you could bring in a 16mm film, develop it straight away, and get it on the air. Without that, this never would have happened. You needed the technology to do that. And by now, the BBC was starting to put money into sports broadcasting. And as you say, it was a happy coincidence of so many things. Whether it would be as known now as it is without that television in coverage of it is maybe debatable, because I've never seen much in the way of radio coverage of that particular event. And in books I've read, I've never really read very much about the impact that had on radio broadcasting. Now, in part, that was because it was done midweek and Sports Report was around by then on BBC Radio, but that was very much a Saturday afternoon thing. There wasn't much midweek coverage of sport on radio then. And that was one area where television had an advantage with something like Sports View. But the 4-minute mile was a huge event. And we're very, very fortunate to have footage of it today.
And just say a little bit more about Sports View itself as a program. So was this the precursor to Grandstand, or was, you know, when did it run when was it on in the week?
So Sports View was on Wednesday evenings, usually around 8:30 or 9 o'clock. Peter Dimmock was the presenter of it. The only reason he was the presenter of it is they didn't have the budget for a presenter. He was staff, and therefore staff no fee. And he would do it. It's famous from a technical viewpoint for being the first show in the UK to use an auto cue. Peter Dimmock had been over in America the previous year and watched sports being presented on NBC, and they had this, they call it in the US, a teleprompter. And the BBC made their own version of it, particularly for Sports View. And that gave it the program had a very newsy feel to it. It had headlines at the start of the program, in the same way how news programs do now. So in that way, it was very pioneering. It had very short, sharp little intros about, tonight on Sports View, you're going to see yada, 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 yada. And then it would go into those particular sections. But it was very news-oriented. It wasn't a feature program. It was about what had happened the previous week and what is going to happen this week in sports. And, at the time, that was a very new concept. It changed later on when After the 1956 Olympics that BBC covered, Sportsview began covering more live events. Early European football matches began getting covered. And you began seeing Sportsview, as it developed over time, into more of a highlights program, which Sports Night later became. But in the beginning, it was very much a news-oriented half-hour program. And eventually, the demand for live sport or highlights of sport that had just taken place began becoming a larger part of the program. But again, that was also reflective in the fact that BBC started showing more sports, and which really takes us to the launch of Grandstand in 1958. So early on in Sportsview's history, two men who became renowned in as broadcasters and as TV men in BBC Sport began getting their fangs into sports broadcasting. One was Brian Cowgill, who was a sports producer, the first head of BBC Sport from a production viewpoint. And the other, of course, was David Coleman. Now, David Coleman started out as a presenter at BBC Manchester and BBC Birmingham as a regional presenter, doing news and sport. But your sport was obviously what he wanted to go into. He began deputizing for Peter Dimmock on Sportsview. There used to be a Saturday night program called Sports Special, which was basically highlights of Saturday sport. And he began presenting that as well in 1956, 1957. And in 1958, Brian Cowgill, Paul Fox and Peter Dimmock wanted to have a Saturday afternoon live sports program. By now, BBC television on a Saturday afternoon more or less had sports running throughout the afternoon. But it was individual sports programs. There was no linking in between them. So it was rather discombobulated. The idea of Grandstand was to bring it all under one umbrella, develop it as a brand, bring you not only the action of the day, the results of the day, the statistics of the day, and get it all into one in one show. Have a presenter who can link everything together, link the outside broadcast units together, have specialist commentators on site around the country, and jump from one event to the other. A great idea with virtually no technology whatsoever to back it up, but the idea was there. In 1958, they had the Commonwealth Games Olympics in Cardiff. And that gave them, okay, we can do this. But even up until a couple of weeks before Grandstand first went out on the air, they were still arguing about the name of it. They were still struggling to get the production facilities they needed. The BBC wouldn't guarantee them a studio at Lime Grove to host it. There were all kinds of internal problems. Not many people believe this would work. Peter Dimmock hosted the first two grandstands before handing over to David Coleman, who began like a 26-year reign behind the desk at Grandstand. And with Grandstand starting in October 1958, it really was the first time anything like this had been attempted. If you look back now, and sadly, again, very few early Grandstands are in the archives. A lot of the sport they showed is in the archives, but the studio parts are missing. They were never recorded in most cases. But believe it or not, Grandstand originally ended at 4:50. Well, that was no good. You needed the soccer results. You needed the horse racing results. You needed, you know, what we now call final score. You needed this as part of the program. Well, they limped along for a couple of months without this. But, I mean, eventually everyone would say, well, this is just ridiculous. If we can't bring the results at the end of this, there's no point in doing the program at all. And, you know, the heads of the BBC eventually got them to 5 and then to 5:10 and so on. And of course, probably the most famous thing people associate with Grandstand in the early years is the teleprinter with the results coming through. And undoubtedly, that was David Coleman's thing. As the results would come through, you know, he'd say something like, you know, Division Two of the Football League, Bradford City 2, Hull 1. Bradford, their first win at home in 6 matches. Hull now defeated in their last 5 games. And all of this was stuff he memorized, you know, beforehand. And he wasn't just like, no one was in his earpiece feeding him that information. That was information he needed. And there's a great sort of Northwest feel to Grandstand in its early years. Brian Cowgill, the presenter, was from the Northwest. David Coleman was from the Northwest. And undoubtedly, their presentation styles were snappy, no nonsense. And it's kind of stereotypical in a way to associate those qualities with people from that area of the country. But I think there's some truth in that. There's also some truth in Grandstand introduced people to sports events that were very regional. Probably the best example of this is rugby league, which essentially in the 1950s was played in working class towns in Yorkshire, Lancashire, Cumbria, but I think that was about it. And people at the time and since mocked Eddie Waring as a rugby league commentator, but he introduced people to this sport. It was shown throughout the winter, almost every week on Grandstand. The second half of a rugby league match was live, and it gave people around the country a look into not only the sporting events of the day, but also the culture of the day. And certainly to many people in the south of England, I imagine watching St. Helens versus Widnes on a cold February afternoon in Lancashire with Eddie Waring commentating in 1958. It must have been looking at something from another planet, a very different social setup. And BBC in the north of England, as far as their sports presentation went, were also very good and ahead of their time at talking about the crowds at events and trying to convey the atmosphere of the events. And, you know, it wasn't uncommon for Grandstand to have racing at Ascot with, you know, very upper class, hoity-toity people, and then going to, you know, the working class suburbs of Manchester for rugby league in the afternoon. But again, it united people from different backgrounds around television on a Saturday afternoon. It made stars not only of the presenters and the commentators, but also of the players. And again, rugby league is a very good example to use here. People began getting to know the players through Eddie Waring's commentaries that were often not technically brilliant, I think, and not an unfair thing to say, but he would talk about the players' interests. He would talk about the players' families. He would talk about, you know, rugby league, although ostensibly a professional sport, most of these men had other jobs as well. Most of those jobs were in the mining, textile, factory industries that were still around in the north at the time. And he would talk about their jobs. It opened up windows of social examination, albeit little windows in a broader context of televising sport, but it did show a general population. There are other things other than sport out there. You know, you're watching sport from all over Great Britain, but not everyone is coming from a background that you may be coming from. You know, you and I were quite lucky probably in where we were brought up and so on. But a lot of people weren't, but they still had this love of sport. And Grandstand in many ways was a great democratizing force for sport, of not only showing high-end sports, but also showing sports like rugby league that became far more popular.
Yeah, and I remember, I mean, actually, I'm pretty sure I do remember David Coleman presenting Grandstand, because before Des Lynam, when did he, was it sort of 84, 85, that kind of period that he finished his run?
Yes, it was. It was a very, David Coleman had a very tempestuous relationship with the BBC throughout his career. He was only in his late 50s when he stopped presenting Grandstand. And to be honest, he probably should have been allowed to continue Because I certainly remember him presenting Grandstand. He was by far my favorite host of Grandstand. He was just so polished and professional at it. And, you know, one of the things about David Coleman especially, and I've learned this in my job as a commentator, is you have to be able to cover not only when things go wrong, but suddenly you've got 30 seconds to fill. And David Coleman could fill 30 seconds with, you know, he could just create something and fill it up. And because I work in TV, I know some of the things he was saying in those 30 seconds is a cue for the people in, you know, in the production. Okay, you've got to get this ready in 10, 9, 8, yeah. 7. And that's the kind of thing I've learned as a broadcaster as well. I know I can say certain things when I've got a few seconds to spare, where I can like transmit my thoughts to people. But Coleman was really good at that. And similarly with his career as a football commentator, he probably should have stayed longer than he did. But at the same time, he was also kind of wise that it's probably better to leave them wanting a bit more than to stay too long.
Yeah, and I certainly remember what you were saying about the democratization of sport, because you know, from childhood, it was always sort of 12:15, 12:30 on a Saturday afternoon, is it right up till final results after 5 o'clock. And it really did bring, you know, at university, people who would, without doubt, all, you know, in the days when people didn't have TVs in their rooms, they'd go to the refectory lounge, you know, and they'd all congregate around the TV. They'd colonize that space between midday. For me, it was always sort of, you'd have the children's programs in the morning, then there'd be the news and weather for about, only on for 5 minutes on a Saturday. And then, of course, you'd have the 5 hours of Grandstand going, you know, I think on Radio 2, you'd have the stereo, in for a period in the 80s, the stereo sequence with Johnny Walker, which was like the musical equivalent of, you know, having with one presenter in a completely different genre, but the same idea of having a program with lots of different components that would take you through from Saturday early lunchtime through till tea time.
Yeah, yeah. And so Grandstand developed itself as a brand, and you began getting things like Olympic Grandstand, World Cup Grandstand, and so on. In 1960, they covered the Grand National for the first time. Now, Mirabelle Topham, who was the owner of Aintree Racecourse, hated television. They managed in 1959 to show some non-Grand National meet races at Aintree. And in 1960, they managed to cover the Grand National for the first time. Again, it was one of these events that united people around the television. It was, you know, the most famous horse race in Britain. I was fortunate enough to know both Peter O'Sullivan and Peter Bromley, who were the commentators for BBC television in 1960 for the first Grand National. When you look back at it now, aside from the fact that obviously we're only looking at a tele recording of it, so the quality of the picture is not as good as it was when it was broadcast, technically the broadcast is very, very good. And it was just one of these events where I think most people who were there watching it remember it quite well. Similarly, in 1964, the Tokyo Olympics, which we'll touch on briefly because in the remaining time we have, I'd like to talk a little more about the 1966 World Cup finals, as obviously that's something that interests many people. The Tokyo Olympics in 1964 had a number of firsts from a broadcasting standpoint. First of all, in Japan, on NHK television, it was covered in color, which was obviously not possible at the time. Satellite television was in its infancy. In theory, the BBC could pick up a few minutes live per day from Tokyo, but the window was very, very narrow. However, we did have enough technology by then to have same-day satellite coverage, in part because of just where Tokyo is in the world and where we are and the time difference. Something that happened in Tokyo earlier in the day, we could cover later that day in the UK. And the 1964 Olympics was a very good Olympics for Great Britain, with people like Lynn Davis, Anne Packer, Mary Rand in track and field events being able to win gold and silver medals as well. The BBC sent out many, many people for the Tokyo Olympics. And by this time, the BBC had enough clout and enough money that they didn't have to take the unilateral feed being offered by NHK. They could take their own cameras out. They could take and cover events from a British standpoint. So certainly by 1964, you got this idea that you can take a major sporting event and cater it to a particular audience. And with the Tokyo Olympics and having so much British success at that Olympics, that was the first time we were able really to do that. It had been done before at the 1960 Olympics in Rome. The BBC, much to the chagrin of Eurovision, didn't subscribe to the unilateral coverage being offered by Eurovision. They sent their own cameras over there and interspersed it and so on. And that worked very well. But it was very different in 1964, just because of the geographical distance and the limits of technology. When you look back now at the 1964 Olympics, some of the pictures coming in were very marginal indeed. But at the same time, this just to be able to see an event the same day in Japan, in the UK, even if it wasn't quite live, what was an amazing thing. I know, speaking to my dad and speaking to some of my teachers when I was a kid who were into sports, they remember the 1964 Olympics just because of the excitement of being able to watch something from the other side of the world.
Yeah, and I think also when you consider that, you know, during lockdown, of course, you know, people were one of the things that disappointed a lot of people was the fact that they couldn't go to the more recent Olympics in Japan, and I think in that sense there is that sense that TV is a lifeline in that era. I mean, I think now, because I was born in, as I think you were, in the 70s, but I remember in the 80s, and like Live Aid with satellite, it was great, but you knew it could go wrong. And in Live Aid, you know, it wasn't perfect. And there were times when the satellite didn't work and we lost a couple of the bands. But in 1964, I mean, that really was groundbreaking.
Oh, totally. And, you know, it's hard to think, but 4 years later, we were broadcasting the 1968 Olympics in color live from Mexico. And so a lot of things happened in those remaining, you know, in that 4 year spurt from 1964 to 1968, which brings us to the 1966 World Cup finals. So the BBC covered the World Cup in 1954 in Switzerland, in 1958 in Sweden. But there was no live coverage at all of the 1962 World Cup finals in Chile. The best the BBC could do was next day coverage on film. The technology just wasn't there. FIFA in 1961 were looking at where they were going to have the World Cup finals in 1966. And the BBC went to FIFA and say, if you bring the World Cup to England, we will cover every game electronically. Now, this meant, of course, that around the world, even if they couldn't watch it live, they would get the best quality pictures, the best quality sound. Everyone in Europe would be able to watch their country's game live via Eurovision. And that really was one of the things where documentation shows that persuaded FIFA to bring the World Cup finals to England in 1966. Very rare in British television history, BBC and ITV combined facilities to cover the 1966 World Cup finals to bring home the promise of covering every match with electronic cameras as opposed to film cameras. So we had for the first time a sharing of facilities, although the BBC had their own commentators and ITV had their own commentators as well. They shared cameras, they shared facility locations, they shared production values. BBC and ITV worked together. The group stages were played around the country in different regions, in the Northwest, in the Midlands, in the Northeast, as well as the London area. And they all worked together more or less pretty well to to cover the 1966 World Cup finals. Undoubtedly, of the people I have spoken to in my life, everyone seems very proud of the fact they were involved in the 1966 World Cup finals coverage. From the BBC standpoint, it undoubtedly was the first World Cup finals where they had pre-World Cup programs, build-up programs to the World Cup. They had World Cup reports every day throughout the tournament. There was various arguments between the BBC and ITV of what matches should be shown live and by who. They all showed England's matches simultaneously. Obviously, BBC and ITV had to work together to cover other countries' matches electronically, but they, as I said, they did a good job with that. There were numerous firsts during the 1966 World Cup. It was the first time slow motion had been used in real time in football coverage. And in the first game of the 1966 World Cup finals, when they first used the action replay, people were calling into the BBC asking if there was something wrong with the coverage. They'd never seen it before. And Brian Cowgill, who was the producer, had, the story goes, he had a phone on his desk. They called him and said, "We need a caption for this. What should we call it?" He just said, "Call it action replay," and put the phone down. And that's how the term started. The 1966 World Cup finals, obviously, everyone knows about it because England won and took place in England. But the promise to other countries to get, especially in Europe, to get their matches shown live, gave other countries the opportunity to also develop their coverage of football. And when you look back through the archives, especially at the 1954 and 1958 World Cup finals, television companies in Europe were already looking to the BBC at how they covered football and began copying the broadcasting style and the presentation style. So it was very much a coming together of many years' experience to put on this great show for 3 weeks.
And the 1966 World Cup is, everyone, is the old expression, 1966 and all that. And of course, the way that rumor has it that Harold Wilson won the general election that he called on the back of the World Cup and got his majority. That's all entered folklore. So do you think really that, of all the events, we've been talking about seven sporting events for the monochrome era this afternoon, is the 66 World Cup, do you think, the sort of the culmination of all of these? Is it the one where really people sort of look at that and say, this is what TV, when it works well, can really do? And it's where people's memories are housed.
I think undoubtedly it is, because throughout all of the other events we've covered, we've talked about, they learn from this, they learn from that. The 1966 World Cup was the culmination of that. When you look at the coverage now, you can see everything is in place. It doesn't really look that different from a modern sports broadcast. Everything is there. It's a well-oiled machine. Obviously, in that era, there were still a few technical problems, but that would have been par for the course, and no one would have been surprised. It really was the culmination of many, many years' work. There's a lot of interesting social aspects of the 1966 FA Cup final. You mentioned Harold Wilson. Harold Wilson wanted to be interviewed straight after the game on the BBC. And they were like, well, that's probably not a good idea. This is a sports program. But they did offer him a halftime interview that he refused. And Brian Cowgill reflected later, well, of course, had Germany been leading at halftime, what would Harold Wilson have said then? But they did interview him often before FA Cup finals in that era on Grandstand as well. So there was definitely this vibe around that time with politics and sports coming together. At the same time as the 1966 FA Cup finals, we were back off the back of the satire boom of the early to mid-1960s. And I think in many ways, that kind of coloured the presentation of sport when it came to dealing with VIPs and people like Harold Wilson, who wanted to more or less capitalize on the facts that the World Cup was in England for their own political purposes. And it always, when you look back at some of the interviews, it's kind of awkward because you can kind of tell David Coleman doesn't really want to be doing it. And Harold Wilson is, you know, just chuntering away about, you know, oh, it's going to be a good game and smoking his pipe. And it's like, okay, that's 3 minutes of our lives. We're never going to get back again. But you have to be somewhat, somewhat nice and respectful to politicians in that era. Speaking of politicians in that era, the BBC very much wanted to cover the 1966 World Cup finals in colour. And a Labour Party politician who was head of GPO communications at the time, Tony Benn, actually said no. And the reason he said no is the British television industry could not manufacture colour televisions in time and in a cost-effective manner to cover it, and he kiboshed the BBC's plans to cover at least the final in colour. The BBC had the cameras, they had the technology to do it, and he said no.
It's funny, isn't it? Because also that was the era of the pirate ships. And it's just the way that the politicians of that era, you know, as exemplified in that film about, you know, the boat that rocked. But yeah, so much in there about the way things could have been done so differently. But, you know, but even I was born in 1973, and I almost imagine that even I can remember the 1966 World Cup final because I didn't watch it at the time, but I feel I must have been there because I've seen and heard the footage so many times since. And just final thoughts, talking about final results just a moment ago, but Craig, what about the future for you? Because obviously with all this information, you know, where is this all going to lead? Because it sounds as though there's a huge project that either you're working on or you can put all your wonderful knowledge to.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things I would like to do in the future is develop a program, if you will, maybe for students of media, of trying to bring some connections together regarding the monochrome era of television, not just in sport, but in other areas, but in sport and what we're talking about here. And for an example, you know, how did we get from the 1948 Olympics to the 1966 World Cup finals? Not only looking at it from a technical viewpoint, but, you know, what were the social implications of it? I'd like to go into that further and draw out the commonalities between them. I think there's a lot of potential there to do so, and then marry that up with what was going on in Britain at the time. There's so much more joining of what was going on politically and socially in Great Britain, how it was reflected in sport in the 1950s and 1960s, not just sport on television, but sport in general. We moved from, you know, sport being an amateur to primarily a professional pastime during that era as well. The social implications of that are still felt in many sports today. And in a sport I'm very passionate about, golf, you know, we still in England have a few old style golf clubs where you have to know the right person to join and that kind of thing. Whereas a lot of sports now are a lot more open or a lot more democratized. Again, we use that word. And I'd love to be able to do a project that looks at the democratization of sport in the 1950s and 1960s and how that was allied with television coverage of sport at the time. I think there's a great deal of research there to be done that hasn't been done by political and social commentators in the past, telling us about how we as a people interpreted sport, learned about sport, and also took part in sport.
Well, Craig, I'll have to have you back, I think. We're just scratching the surface, I think. And I really hope that project blossoms. But Craig, thank you so much for the second time for being my guest on the Nostalgia Interviews podcast.
You're welcome.